Welcome to our final day, our fourth day of our Holy Week talks. There won't be a talk tomorrow on Good Friday. Just to remind you that tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock will be our Good Friday communion service, and all are welcome to come and join us as we're sharing communion together. Today we're looking at words that Jesus speaks in as he's praying in Gethsemane. Not what I will, but what you will. Mark 14 verse 36. And as we've done on each of the previous days, we look at the passage that this verse forms a part of. We think about the context as it fits into the story that Mark is telling us and the wider story of the Bible. We think about what it means, what is God showing us or teaching us through this passage. And then thinking about how do we apply to ourselves, what can we take from this and maybe change the way we live as followers of Jesus. So these words, not what I will, but you will, comes from that prayer that Jesus prays in Gethsemane that we find in Mark 14, verses 32 to 42. And this is what Mark writes. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that, if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Once more he went away and prayed the same thing, and when he came back he again found them sleeping, because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." This passage comes after Jesus and his disciples have shared in the Passover meal, during which Jesus took the bread at the meal, broke it, gave it to his disciples and said to them, "Take it, this is my body." And then he takes the cup, and again after giving thanks he gives it to his disciples, who all drink from the cup. And then Jesus says, "This is my blood of the new covenant." After singing some hymns, they then head off to the Mount of Olives, and on the way there Jesus has a conversation with his disciples in which Peter says to Jesus that he would rather die with Jesus than disown him. When they arrive in Gethsemane, Jesus leaves eight of his disciples at the edge of the garden and takes James, John, and Peter further into the garden with him. Why does he invite them to go with him? The answer is a simple answer. Jesus doesn't want to be alone. In Genesis 2, when God forms the man and puts him in the garden, God realizes that it is not good for the man to be alone, and so he makes a companion. When difficult times come our way, when we're facing a struggle ahead of us that we know is coming our way, we want people to be around us because they comfort us, they strengthen us, and sometimes we just want someone else to be there to reassure us that we don't have to face things alone. As Jesus enters into the garden, knowing that the hour is not far away, there are two things he wants: fellowship with God and fellowship with his friends. That's the events leading up to this passage. And what's going to happen after this passage are the events that are well known to us: the betrayal, the arrest, the trial, the condemnation, the crucifixion, and the death. This passage is the start of what we call the passion of Jesus. When we think of the word passion, we often think of it in terms of strong emotions, but the word itself has its roots in suffering. When we think about what happens to Jesus over the next 24 hours, we can see both of these definitions combined. Jesus' immense suffering, but suffering because of his incredible love for us. So let's shift across to the meaning. Let's look at what Mark is showing us here. We talk about Jesus being both fully God and fully man. Much of what we see of Jesus in the rest of Mark's gospel, the healings, the miracles, point to his divinity. But here we see the humanity of Jesus. And it does make for difficult reading, because the Jesus we have encountered through Mark's gospel, particularly when he's talking about his own suffering and the suffering of his followers, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. That Jesus seems to be in control of his emotions, of his understanding of the necessity of his suffering and death. But what we see here is that understanding the necessity of something and being faced with the reality of it are two different things. There are two things I want to highlight from the words that Jesus prays, because I believe they are important for us as followers of Jesus. Knowing what he's about to go through in the next 24 hours, the first thought that enters Jesus' head is that he would rather not. Abba Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Jesus' reference to the cup echoes his words just a couple of hours earlier as he held the cup of wine. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many. Jesus' whole life was leading to the cross and the suffering that must precede it. But now it is just hours away. This man who had never experienced sin in his life was on the verge of having all the sins of the world placed upon him. He was about to experience the pain of judgment, of guilt, of abandonment. Father, you can do anything and everything. If there is any other way that people can be reconciled to us, he is praying, can we rather choose that path? Jesus is the Son of God, but in this story, he is also a 33-year-old man. And no one wants to die when they're 33, and they have more years ahead of them than behind them. When Jesus goes back to his disciples and says to them, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, he is talking to them from his own experience. The flesh takes us down a path of selfishness and self-preservation, of me first. But the spirit, that spark of life that God has breathed into us, longs for heavenly values. But even in this moment of human weakness, of desiring a different path, he then utters words we're highlighting today. Yet not what I will, but what you will. In other places in Mark's gospel, some that we have looked at this week, Jesus tells his followers with faith and prayer, all things are possible, including moving mountains and transforming fig trees full of leaf into withering remnants of what they once were. But here Jesus adds something vitally important to that prayer. Not what I will, but what you will. If we have real faith in God, then we will only ever pray that God's will be done. And so in spite of his desire for the cup to be taken from him, he is willing to follow the Father's plan that he dies. This also shows us that despite that our God is one, the three persons of the Trinity are still distinct in their identity. Jesus is not talking to himself. We see here that Jesus was the complete servant of God's will. Clifton Black, a professor of biblical theology, points out that on the night of his betrayal, Jesus proved himself the faithful disciple that none of his own disciples could be. As Jesus comes before the Father in prayer, he has two requests, one temporary and one long-lasting. One specific and one more general. That specific but temporary request, take this cup from me. But the general long-lasting request is the one that he teaches us to pray. Not what I will, but what you will. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So what does this mean for us today? Yesterday I mentioned a thread that ran through the talks this week, and this passage today is the conclusion that thread needed. Although the choices we have been challenged with this week are incomparable to what Jesus was about to face in this passage, when we are faced with difficult decisions, we can often agonize over making them. On Monday we looked at the words, have faith in God. And we have thought this week about the things we do in the church, the activities of the church, and whether they are fruitful or just give the appearance of being fruitful. Busy, just for busyness sake, is not why we are a church. We are called to be fruitful, not busy. On Tuesday, we looked at the words Jesus said, you are not far from the kingdom. And we thought about church traditions, the things we do, or the way we have done things for generations. And the challenge was to think about why we do them. What is the heart behind doing them? Are we doing them out of habit? Are we doing them out of loyalty to the saints who have gone before us? Or are we doing them because they draw us closer to God? Because they express our love for God? And then yesterday, Jesus said those words, the poor you will always have with you. And it was a bit more personal. We thought about the things that keep us busy, the work of the kingdom. and whether we were allowing the work of the kingdom to become an idol at the cost of worshipping the king. Letting go of things that we have come to love is a very hard thing to do. And so if we think very critically about the challenges that have been laid out for us this week, our prayer could easily echo the first words of this prayer. Can I just hold on to these things? Can we not let them go? Can we keep doing them? It's okay if we do new things, but can we please keep doing the things we've always done? The things we're comfortable with. Letting go is hard because so often our identity is wrapped up in the things we do. When we meet people for the first time, is one of the first questions we ask them not, so what do you do? When we tell people who we are, how often don't we describe it in terms of what we do? I'm a teacher, I'm a mechanic, I'm a lawyer, I'm retired. To stop doing things almost feels like we are losing who we are. But what if our identity was far greater than just what we do? What if our identity was wrapped up in our Creator? In Genesis 1 verse 27 says, God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God he created them, male and female he created them. What if our identity doesn't stem from how we or others see us, but how God sees us? In 1 John 3 verse 1 it says, see what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. And what if our identity was wrapped up not in what we have done, but in what Jesus has done? John 1 verse 12 says, to all who believed him and accepted him, he gave the right to become children of God. If our real identity is not based on ourselves, on the things we do, or that others see us do or expect us to do, but on the God who created us, who loves us and who died for us, then surely as we consider all we have heard this week, then our prayers must conclude in the same way that Jesus prayed it. Not what I will, but what you will.